This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
February 23rd, 2019. This is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs, where the weatherman says we're going to have more snow tomorrow. Just think, spring is right around the corner. Thank goodness. I appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org, and I invite you to visit and subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net, where you can look at the archives of the program. You may also listen to the archives at republicbroadcasting.org, and you should subscribe to the archives there. I also invite you to visit and subscribe to ScreeningSandyHook.net. During the program, email questions or comments to comment@spingola.email, and if you inadvertently add an S to comment, it's fine. It will still reach me. And if you want to ask questions and you don't want to call into the program, then visit the chat room, which is at spingola.chatango.com, or just send me an email at comment@spingola.email. Now, I know I say this every week, and probably I always say things just once, and I think, oh, people will get it, but that's just not the case. I notice that professional broadcasters repeat things several times, and I'm definitely not what you would consider a professional broadcaster, even though I've been doing this for some time, over 8 years. Anyway, you can view our past, current, and future guest lineup at spingola.com, where you will find the schedule all the way back to October 23rd, 2010. Just visit spingola.com, click on the radio schedule button on the left, choose the appropriate year and month, and see all of the links and other resources available there. Our guest today is Lois Letchford, L-E-T-C-H-F-O-R-D. Her website is loisletchford.com. Lois is the author of Reversed, a memoir, available everywhere books are sold, and is available in paperback, hardcover, and ebook. I have the ebook edition. And Reversed is such an amazing story. I was brought to tears several times reading this book. Reversed is a memoir of profound determination that follows the highs and lows of overcoming impossible odds, turning one woman into a passionate teacher for children who have been left behind. Yet nothing is impossible when one digs deep and looks at the students through a new lens, which is what Lois did. And bless her heart, what an amazing story. Lois, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's lovely to be on your show.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on the program. It's wonderful to read your book. It's just an amazing thing. I could really relate to it, some of the things you wrote. And And the fact that you're a mom, I'm a mom, that we would do anything for our children to help them to succeed and to overcome their challenges. And you did such an amazing thing, and you had faith in your son, and I so enjoyed the story of the swim coach, which was, oh, what a fabulous guy he was. And then as I was reading further in some of the other modalities that you used, I thought, well, the swimming was perfect for Nicholas because it was
the swimming.
It was,
yeah.
Yes. So anyway, tell us about this beautiful son of yours who is now a professor.
And he's not a professor. He's a doctor. He's a doctor. He's Dr. Nicholas Richmond.
Okay.
Yeah. He's a consultant now.
That is so amazing. It is just so wonderful. Mm. And, yes, he is. And he went to Oxford?
He went to Oxford. After being in high school in Lubbock, Texas.
Amazing. That is just terrific. And there's a picture of him on your website. And again, that website is loisletchford.com. And that's LETCHFORD. And this story starts out in Brisbane, Australia. So tell us a little bit of background about this wonderful, wonderful son, Nicholas.
Well, Nicholas went to school, and I was very concerned about sending him to school because he seemed slow. And when children are behind and you send them to school, you don't really quite know what's going to happen. And it was a disaster. And he could not even dress himself for school once during the school year. So that was the start of the story and the start of the journey. And it's only recently that I realized the implication for that terrible year of school. So that was the start of it. And yeah, it was terrible. My poor boy, you know, he's 30 now, and I asked him about this year and he couldn't even talk.
Oh, bless his heart. That must have been so trying for him to, I'm sorry, I'm very emotional when it comes to children. And when I was reading about the day that, you know, you'd pick him up and he just, well, you tell it. You tell us.
I pick him up from school, and he, you know, he just, even the first day of school, he just wants to go home. And the second, the day six of school, I'll never forget it, the teacher said, well, you know, he can't do anything. He's so far behind, he'll never catch up. And that was, that memory is still in my mind. It was horrendous. Listening to the teacher say these things about a little six-year-old child. And as I write and rewrite now, her mindset was made up there and then. This child is so dumb. It doesn't matter what I do or what I say. He won't do anything. And she was so wrong. And it's how we cannot tell the IQs of children at 6 years old.
The other thing, too, is that I think her attitude, I think that Nicholas could sense her attitude. And of course he was going to be stressed out. And this stress led to his daily, he urinated his pants daily. That's probably due to the stress he was feeling. Being in a classroom where the teacher has absolutely no respect for you as a human being and has no hope for you. That poor little child. What a stressful situation. And of course, what, you were just, you have an older son, you had a younger son, and Nathaniel was doing great, and you were doing what was expected, and this was again in Australia, and oh gosh, what a trying situation for the entire family, and particularly for him.
If I were to do it again, I would have taken him out of school.
The second day, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I should have taken him out. We should not let our children sit in such stressful situations that they cannot talk about it 20 years later.
Yes. And I've said the same thing. If I had it to do over again, I would have. But...
Yes.
But you gain wisdom through it, and he overcame it. That is the beauty of it. And then he had this wonderful swim coach, Bob Cousin.
Yes. Yes.
And he thrived. Your little Nicholas thrived. So you had two teachers to compare. The one was just amazing with him and was intuitive and listened and honed in on Nicholas and what his were. And then you had this horrible other teacher who was just set in her way. She'd been teaching there for 30 years, which of course made her an expert, quote unquote, right?
And we were in a high socioeconomic area.
Sure.
We are at the best school, the school that everyone wants to go to, and this is what happens.
Yes. Yes. And I personally am against government schools. I just think that there are better options, and particularly for, and I don't even consider, would you consider Nicholas a special needs child or just a special child who saw the world differently?
I like the second version better.
Yes. Yes, I do too.
Yes, I certainly like that. You know, he's a special child. And I want children, you know, as I think about this and I teach children who struggle with reading, I want teachers to know how impactful their teaching is. And I want children to be in the regular classroom with teachers with knowledge.
Absolutely. But the other thing that was so impressive as was the school play, The Giant Turnip.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
He had memorized every single word. Every single word.
Yes.
Wasn't that amazing? Which disproved what the teacher said. Absolutely disproved it. And that was
important. That was memory. What was important about that was that she's not reading, it was acting. It was a total change in reading strategy.
Yes.
Which was so important.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, that was phenomenal. And that really did show me this kid has an amazing memory.
Yes. Yeah, I just love that story. And your parents lived, what was it, 50 minutes away? Or very close.
Yes.
And, when they came to visit, she brought her bird, was it a parakeet? They call it different.
Different. They call it budgerigar in Australia. It's a little budgerigar. Oh, yes.
He must have been quite the sweet little pet.
Oh my, yes. My mother had a number of those parakeets, because the bird budgerigars, because they would fly in her house. And,
oh,
you know, you do sit
there.
Well, hers was a pet.
Right.
Hers was a pet, but she had it flying in the house.
Oh, right, okay.
And I went to the windows, you know, these white windows, to shut the window with my bird on the shoulder, and it flew out.
Uh-oh. What?
Oh, and then we had to go and chase him, and then the other birds were attacking him and got him back that time. But other times we didn't get him back.
Oh, wow. Anyway.
Oh, that was so funny. Anyway.
Nicholas had a great relationship with your parents. And what a special person he was and is. Yes. So anyway, tell us what you did to help him.
Well, the first thing that happened was when he went into the second grade, the teacher gave me a set of spelling words that made learning so easy. She gave a word, the words list was cat, hat, rat, bat, you know, all rhyming words in one different word.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed me, you know, Nicholas came to me and said, can you help me with my spelling words? And he sat at the table with a pencil and paper, his shoulders hunched up to his ears. As I said, now write this word. And he couldn't even write a letter. He didn't know where to start. And my heart just sank because I thought, this kid doesn't know a thing. And I took him outside and played with clay. We worked with clay. And it was phenomenal. And the other part that's interesting about this was he worked with me for an hour and a half after school. Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday. And then Thursday evening we used alphabet letters and wrote it in pencil. And Friday morning I tested him orally. And that happened for about 6 weeks until he was confident he could know all the letters, know the sounds and how to write each one.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing even to think about it. You know, this little six and a half year old boy was so intent on achieving his goals even then.
Yes, he was, or he wouldn't be where he is now.
Yeah.
And he loves books. He loved books. He loved reading.
Yes. He loves all sorts of things. He's amazing. Even now, the things he reads, I can't read.
And you had a background in education, and your husband Chris also was a professor. And you had the opportunity, or do I call it an opportunity, or the challenge of moving sometimes to different places for 6 month period of time, which would have been kind of exciting in certain circumstances, but was kind of a challenge. Well, you know, how would Nicholas handle this challenge of moving and having changes and go ahead.
Yes, no, the move to Oxford for 6 months, you're right. It's both exciting and a challenge. It's very hard on me.
Right.
Very hard. And you're really dependent on the graces of people you meet. And you just don't quite know what's happened. And we had a big house and my parents were with us just a couple of days. But my parents-in-law stayed with us for about on and off for 2 months, and that was incredible to have them there with us. But the experience actually changed Nicholas's life.
Yes.
It changed his life, and I'm still going, how did this happen? How did this all line up to be such a critical component of his learning? Because I can tell you what would have happened if we had never left Australia. He would have been put with a special ed reading teacher. He would have been given phonics. He would have been told, this is how you learn. And he would not have been able to do it.
Right.
And the teacher, the reading.
We are going to a quick 3 minute break. We will be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me.
We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, we are back. And my guest today is Lois Letchford, and her website is loisletchford.com. And you were telling us before we went to the break about the schedule that that Nicholas was to have in the second grade, which seemed overwhelming to me. He was going to have all of these various teachers and various programs, and it seemed so overwhelming to me, and it also seemed like it would categorize him as special needs, which I don't think he was. I think he was special,
You're exactly right. It's interesting to read the literature around this and how mindset plays a role. He had had an IQ test, which said he wasn't very smart. You'd had the failure in first grade, which said he wasn't very smart. Then you have the teaching that does the normal and the standard for this child who's different. And it all forms a nice little circuit. Well, he can't read. He can't do it because, you know, and that's the cycle that has to be broken.
Indeed. Yes, each child is special. Each child is different. And you watched a TV program that was very interesting to me, and the program was A New Start for Underachievers. I don't like to even say he's an underachiever. When I first started reading the book, I thought he's an empath. He just has a different way of looking at things. He's introspective. He just appreciates different aspects of the world than maybe somebody else.
He certainly does. And there are two components to his life that made a difference. And one is that I myself would be dyslexic. And the second was that he had ear infections from 8 to 18 months.
Oh.
And ear infections impact brain growth.
Oh my gosh.
It impacts language. Yes, it impacts language development.
Oh my gosh.
And
now, from how old to how old?
8 to 18 months. Critical component when the brain is growing and absorbing language. Yes.
And so he probably had allergies.
Possibly, yes. Undiagnosed.
My. Yes. Sometimes the ear infections are a result of vaccines and things. I had ear infections. Oh gosh, it was just up until I was 8. I had a mastoid infection.
Oh.
It was a terrible situation. I missed a lot of school because of it. And, they're very painful. And
yes.
I remember how awful it was.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I attributed that to vaccines later.
That was very much. I just wonder how much comes from just the structure of his ear. No, and I don't know about the anatomy of all that, but I know a lack of language at that early stage impacts child development.
Right, and if he couldn't hear, then of course it would impact his language development.
Yes.
It had nothing whatsoever to do with his brain.
That's
wow.
Right. Well, it does. It affects the brain because from what I've been reading, you know, when the brain doesn't use things, it loses them.
Right.
So you're losing that language that you need that's so critical come later
right.
on.
But when you can't hear through an infected ear, then you're not going to develop at the same speed those language your language is not going to be developing. I remember that I couldn't hear out of one ear, and if you can't hear something, you're not going to learn it. Oh,
right.
It's such a critical age.
Yeah.
Oh, bless his little heart.
Yeah. That really impacted his growth and learning. And yes, very sad, really.
Yes.
I feel quite responsible for that.
No. I'm not going to let you do that.
Thank you.
No, not in this program. You're a hero mom as far as I'm concerned. So, no. And moms do that. We think, oh, if I'd only done this, if I'd only done that. But we can't do that. We all do the best that we possibly can. And that's what you did. So you can't go back and say, you know, don't feel guilty. You certainly have no cause to feel any guilt at all. So, okay, we're going to take a short 3-minute break and we'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
Alrighty, we are back. And our guest today is Lois Ledgeford. Her website is loisledgeford.com, and she is the author of Reversed, a memoir. It is available everywhere books are sold, and it is available in paperback, hardcover, and ebook. And anyone that has an interest in humanity and children should read this book, because it's just a book that offers hope and example. It's just a lovely book, and I do hope that that you will buy the book and read it. And okay, so we're talking about children, and a very good friend of mine said a few years back, we refer to young people as children, not kids. They are not goats. They are children. And I think that's important when we're talking about young people, that we accord them the respect of being a child and not a kid.
Yes.
So
they come to us with a lot of knowledge.
Yes,
with their own little experience, and we have to expand on that and take them from where they are, not where we would like them to be.
Yes. So after this second grade schedule that they had him, that they gave to you, which that would have been overwhelming for any child.
Yes, second grade, the classroom teacher was brilliant. I still love her. Nicholas doesn't actually remember her, but she was wonderful. It was the reading teacher who was caused more of the problems and was more rigid and had more of the fixed mindset.
Mm.
So, when we went to Oxford in the second half of 1995, I actually repeated what the reading teacher was doing. It was a total failure. So it really caused me to stop and say, do something differently. And thankfully, my mother-in-law was with me saying, make learning fun. And that was the start of the transformation. And I'm still amazed at what happened, and just tapping into Nicholas's curiosity and seeing this boy with this incredible brain.
Yes.
We judge children by their speech. Because he was slow with speech, we think he cannot think.
Amazing.
And that's a fallacy. And once you tap into his mind, is going 100 miles an hour, and I'm seeing maybe 2% of it.
Wow.
That's the way I see him today.
The what was initially a challenge of moving to Oxford really was a blessing in disguise because of what you were able to achieve, particularly with the help of your husband, Chris's parents, and their support. And so it was really a wonderful, good thing. That is amazing.
This is where I have a little chuckle. Because we did, literally, we caught the bus outside of Christchurch, Oxford, and Christchurch is one of the 20-odd colleges in Oxford. And that was the Abingdon bus, because we lived in Abingdon about 20 minutes, I think, south of Oxford. And we didn't have a car, so we did everything by bus. And we would catch the bus, and we get off at Christchurch and get on at Christchurch, and you never go into Christchurch. And if you want a story to start in one place and finish in another, when my son goes back to Oxford to do his PhD, his college is Christchurch.
Oh, my gosh.
Did you pick that up in the book, or did that?
No, I didn't, but that is just incredible. And I often say there really are not any coincidences. There are just places that we should be and times that we should be at those places that are meaningful and not coincidental.
I have
to agree
with you.
That is amazing. That is really amazing.
I wonder how many people actually realize that, because it's, in a way, it's subtle in the book. In a way, it's obvious, mm-hmm. but another way, it's quite subtle.
Mm-hmm. Now,
yes,
before
Oxford, you know,
before you left, and you did watch that television program about a new start, and ANSUA for short.
Yes.
Now, your husband didn't view Nicholas in the same way. Why do you think that is?
Oh, you know, my husband's an academic and he's a mathematician. And when Nicholas was tested, you know, they put him in the lowest category possible. Mm-hmm. And my husband understands the mathematics behind it. And he said, well, you know, that's just Nicholas isn't like that. That's, he can look like that on any given day, I think is what he said. And he could see Nicholas's spatial awareness, the way he did puzzles and the way he could build and his concentration. So kid who's can do all of those things. But what wasn't acknowledged, and even through that test, is that Nicholas had a language problem. And when you have a language problem, and it's like speaking in a foreign language, and we're going to test you in the foreign language, how well can you achieve in that foreign language?
Of course. And the puzzles. He was great at doing puzzles and really big puzzles, not just, you know, elementary kinds of puzzles, but he was fabulous at doing this. And what else did he like to do that was kind of an amazing thing for somebody that was considered that couldn't be educated?
One of Nicholas's big strengths was his concentration, his ability to stick at a task, even then. It's quite astounding. And they were the biggest things, I think, you know, the concentration and the spatial awareness as a little child. But, you know, even today, as he's married and his wife is living with him and sometimes despairs, he's this boy who has enormous discrepancies, not just a few. You know, in his spatial awareness, he sits on the 99th percentile, and language is the absolute opposite extreme. Hello?
You cut out just a little bit. Yes, you cut out just a little bit.
I thought so.
Yes. Language is, what did you say about language?
His language sits in the lowest percentiles, under 10% in some of his language skills.
Still?
Yes.
He's a thinker.
He's a thinker. Definitely
yes,
a thinker.
Yes, he's a thinker. Huh.
So it causes some challenges, but, you know, he takes them in his stride and he works incredibly hard around the problems that he presents and he has. So I just take my hat off to him and think, you know, you'll get there. Someone will see your strength. We'll get through this again.
Right. Now, one of the individuals, Susan, she was not a very nice person.
There's a moral in the story, isn't there?
Yes. Oh, gosh. And the implication was, she said, oh, well, you and your husband are both smart. You will have to accept that Nicholas is not like you. In layman's terms, she is saying he's dumb, thick as a brick. Quote, unquote. What a terrible thing to imply to parents. And what if you had believed that?
I'm just sitting here nodding my head. You are absolutely right. What if we had believed it? And what if we hadn't had the time in Oxford? Because the school believed it.
Right. And how many parents have been told this and have believed it because they're listening to authority figures and they didn't think it through and didn't analyze their child and look at his other abilities and say, now wait a minute, wait, I'm going to really go against this. This is not the child that I know he is. He can do all of these other things. But if parents believe this about their child, that child gets lost in the system. They often end up having a terrible life, for one thing, and getting into trouble. Yeah. And it's because they were different, and their differences were not appreciated. They did not, the teachers did not look at them in the same way. They looked at them as if to say, he's dumb. There's no chance.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it takes quite a lot to stand up against the force of evidence that school brings to you.
Oh, absolutely. Because as I say, they're authority figures and they're supposed to know what they're doing and they've had this education, that they're to be able to educate people. And, I've studied quite a bit about government schools and they have certain statistics and certain principles and policies that they have to follow. And they are, after all, government schools. They are not looking out for each individual child. They have certain policies. And if you don't fit into what they consider the norm, then they consider you as, not being able to be educated. And how many children fall through the cracks and end up in society as people who are unsuccessful, or maybe even criminal, who end up in the prison system? What a terrible waste of talent.
I wonder what would have happened to Nicholas if we hadn't had the time in Oxford, because I think he would have committed suicide. I think something dramatic would have happened. You know, I don't know. It's just too hard to even contemplate.
Well, if he is still unable to talk about this at the age of 30, if it's that traumatic, I'm sure you're right.
Yes.
That he would have done something desperate. He felt desperate just in the first grade, I believe.
Yes, he was. He was desperate in the first grade. He couldn't dress himself. He couldn't do a thing. You know, that's why I said I should have taken him out of school in that year. And I know this because I recently talked to him. I spent time with him and his wife last year. And I speak to them every week. But when I was with them, I was recording little bits of him and talking explicitly about what do you remember about these times. And that, you know, the first year in school he couldn't talk about. But then he said, I remember all the poems you wrote. And I remember that silly poem we did, and I wrote a spell. I wrote a spell for the witch's brew. And he's 30, and he still remembers that. And that's the change that needed to happen.
Right.
And I was so surprised that here's me writing these silly poems and thinking, oh, they're just funny things, but that he has a memory of them.
Right.
And that was the transformation that was so important. And the difference in his demeanor is phenomenal. You know, he's crying about grade one and laughing and smiling. And that poem, he said, I can't remember what we did, but he said it was so funny. And I remember him reacting to it and showing this, his ingredients, his spells to people as they came to the door and just laughing over it. And that's his memory. And it, you know, it showed me how important the learning, what we're doing with children is.
Mm-hmm.
That they do, that it's an emotional component that goes alongside it. When they're failing and can't do it, it's a depression and it's sadness. When they're enjoying it and loving it and writing from it, you've got the entirely opposite child coming about.
Right. I thought a lot about some experiences that I had in school and mm-hmm. some of the things that teachers said, not to me, but to other people.
But to others.
To other children. And I remember in the sixth grade, Mrs. Brown, she was a lovely woman. She was a very nice woman. And IQ tests were very, they placed a great deal of importance on IQ tests. And I scored very high. And she, one day in class, she targeted this other child, Gary. I'm not going to say his last name. But she said, and he was the cut up of the class. He was funny, and he was really funny, but he wasn't a good student, but he was just kind of a class clown, and she said, would you believe that Gary and Deanna have the same IQ, and look at how Gary acts? In front of a class of probably, 30 students. We'll be right back. Back, and our guest is Lois Letchford. Her website is loisletchford.com. And I was telling this story because what she did in that class, what this nice teacher did in that class was destroy whatever was left of Gary's self-esteem, I think. And I always remembered that, and I think, wow, even at the age of whatever I was in the sixth grade, that I remember that story and I thought, what a shame. That could have destroyed him for the rest of his school career. That was so terrible to me. Teachers can do that.
And we remember it.
Yes, I did. And it wasn't even about me. It was about somebody else. And I think that I'm sure she must have been well. I can't attribute that to her. It doesn't seem well-meaning to me at all. And she should have known better.
Yeah.
But I think teachers sometimes do that, I don't know whether she was trying to, that was discouragement to me. There's no way you could say that was encouragement to Gary. And I often wonder what happened to Gary.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
But, tell us a little bit about the organization that you went to, what's it called?
ANSUA.
Right.
Yes, it's what you do when you're absolutely desperate.
Right.
You know, you're looking, and I think I'm looking for ways around the problem. And so we went to, you know, to these people, and you know, what they were doing is actually not bad. You know, building up the muscle tone and having them do all of the physical exercises, very much like OT, and strengthening the fingers by popping bubbles, what do you call that stuff, the plastic bubble wrap. That strengthens the pencil grip fingers, and all of that is very good. The only problem is you cannot then make the jump. It's going to help them learn to read. That's the problem. But everything else that they did was very beneficial. And Nicholas ended up doing monkey bars and getting very strong shoulders, which led to his career as a swimmer in high school. So
right. So yeah. It did, and that very was good. When you and when she was talking to you, it was Marjorie, Miss Marjorie. Yeah. You told her about the ear infections. And that he was a late talker, and probably because of those ear infections. And didn't they also do some training like moving of the legs and the arms and that kind of thing?
We did. And we did those exercises morning and night for about 6 months.
Wow.
My husband and I, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. 30 minutes morning and 30 minutes a night. I mean, it might have been very good for Nicholas. I think it wasn't very good for my other two sons. And it's something we shouldn't have read. That was wasted.
Yes.
But,
okay.
You know.
We're at the top of the hour. We will be right back. So stay with us and we'll be right back and continue our conversation with this wonderful mother.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Lois Letchford. And her website is loisletchford.com, and I'm going to post that again in the chat room. And I do invite you to visit the chat room at spingola.chatango.com. And we were talking about Marjorie and about the exercises that you did. And I'm kind of familiar with those exercises where you put the child or the individual up on a table and you work with their arms and legs but you say that was quite an experience that didn't really help. And what was the effect on your other two sons?
Nothing obvious, but I'm just aware that they were neglected while we were, Nicholas was the center of attention, really.
Right.
I think that's the main thing.
The way that I'm familiar with that is I volunteered one several years ago. There was a young woman, a college student, who was in a traffic accident. She was asleep in the back seat, and a car hit that side. She had brain damage, and so we went over to her house. She had volunteers every morning, and we would move her arms and legs. But she was brain damaged. That's a totally different kind of situation than what Nicholas had.
Yeah. So, but it's the same sort of theory, isn't it, behind it?
Right, right.
Yeah. I wouldn't do that again.
No, but then I thought, oh, I wonder what swimming, the swimming would have been similar to that, in that he was using his arms and legs. But I think the teacher was more of a factor with his swimming success. Don't you?
The teacher was definitely a factor with his swimming success. He was absolutely wonderful. And most the teachers, you know, would sit Nicholas on the side and my heart would sink, and Rob Cusack came along and said, "I'll look after you, Nicholas." And he was just wonderful. You know, and he was very experienced, and he had a passion for teaching these children who struggled.
Right.
And it made a difference. Yeah. Yeah, he was phenomenal. Yeah. I've been in touch with him.
Have you really?
Yes.
Oh, that's terrific. So he's still around?
Yes, he's finished coaching, but he's still around and he's doing more traveling now.
That's wonderful. And I remember the one story in the book where he wanted Nicholas to swim the entire length of the pool. And then Nicholas said, "Well, if you could stand in the middle, then I could do this." And which showed the trust that Nicholas had in his wonderful teacher. And when he was having trouble about breathing, okay, which side do I breathe? And and Nicholas is ambidextrous.
Yes.
And so he drew a little dot on his hand, and he said, "Okay, when you see that hand, then you'll know to raise your head and take a breath," or something to that nature. How creative and intuitive.
Yes.
So, yeah. And they named that swimming pool after him, after the teacher?
Yes, well, he was an Olympic swimmer.
Yes, he.
Yes, he went to the 1968 Olympics and swam the 100 meters freestyle and butterfly.
Right. Yes.
Sorry, you know, amazing.
But that didn't make him the great teacher. I look at him as a teacher more than as an Olympian. Yes.
I agree.
Yes.
Yes. He's absolutely wonderful. He was so patient. And when he asked Nicholas to swim the length of the pool, it was just change over time for swim lessons. So Nicholas was the only one in the pool, but the pool deck was crowded with two lots of swimmers, those that were coming and those that are leaving. And everyone stopped and watched Nicholas swim the length of the pool.
And how did that affect Nicholas?
Oh, he was so excited. Everyone cheered for me, Nana. Everyone cheered for me.
Yes, he called his grandmother and told her.
Exciting. Yeah.
What did you learn from Bob that helped you to do what you did?
My eldest son said, "Mum, he was so important because he showed you that there were ways around the problem. And it was important that Nicholas could achieve like every other child, It just took a different route. And I think that was a very important learning lesson for me right there and then.
Yes. I agree. I think that he was inspired. He inspired you and he inspired Nicholas. And I think Nicholas, he grew. He grew emotionally and his confidence grew. And what a wonderful experience that gave to him.
Yes.
That he knew that he could accomplish something. Because he did accomplish it, and other people saw him accomplish it, and instead of being looked at as, oh, he's dumb as a brick, he was a wonderful swimmer, and everybody saw that he was a wonderful swimmer. Ah, what a glorious moment.
Yes, it was. It was. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, So tell us more about what you did, how you worked with this wonderful human being, Nicholas.
Well, the Oxford component, you know, when I started writing these poems, it changed the classroom first up. Nicholas wasn't failing. I was doing more reading too. And basically I was immersing him in language, but it was language he could understand. You're doing different sorts of language, and we're always illustrating these poems. And Nicholas loved it. And through that, I fell into, you know, you come up with the double O, comes up as a group of letters you have to learn, and that's got cook, look, and book. And here we are sitting in Oxford, and I wrote this poem about Captain Cook, the last of the great explorers. And Nicholas and I went on a search for these maps, and it actually was the most unbelievable experience that Nicholas, again, still remembers. He loves mapping, loves history, and loves exploring, and it blew my mind then, and it still blows my mind now.
That is very amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tapping into a child's curiosity, but it was through the poems so that you can doing the decoding and finding rhyming words, and giving all this phonemic awareness within the language that we need to teach them to read. And it was just astounding what happened. And so we're looking for maps, and Nicholas asked me, can I see Captain Cook's original map, which I knew
Oh my goodness.
And then he said, and who came before Captain Cook? Well, I said, well, that's Christopher Columbus. And who came before Columbus? And I sat there and said, I don't know. Let's find out. And eventually, through going to the library, and I had to do a lot of reading to find out what was happening, we came up with this name, Ptolemy, and Ptolemy did the first mapping of the world, back in about 250 AD, and I said, Nicholas, we should be able to find the Ptolemy maps. We go to the Bodleian Library, which is, you know, a huge library, but they have a bookshop attached to it. And I went to the gift shop lady and said, where would we see the Ptolemy maps? And the lady reached down behind the counter, picked up this big volume of maps, put it on the table and said, and that'll be £5, please.
Wow.
And we walked out of the Bodleian Library with a book of Ptolemy maps, and Nicholas ruled because they were accurate enough to recognize the countries. And I mean, the accuracy of them for that day was phenomenal. But then you can compare what we know today with what was being drawn then. And Nicholas just had a ball, and he literally drooled over those maps. So that was where his interest in mapping and the world history and all of it all started.
Wow. So what you were doing was really homeschooling, and you were tuning into his needs, and only a person who is homeschooling their child would have the interest and the love of that child to be able to understand what would encourage and provoke further knowledge What an adventure. Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, you've got a seven-year-old. No way in the world would you do the history of world mapping with most children.
Of course not.
It was the perfect subject. It still amazes me that, you know, he just fell in love with learning alongside learning to read. So you've got the two things going on together, and it makes a difference when you come to do the more difficult stuff of the decoding, which he really struggled with. But even then, I was given a book in England that just transformed my life and teaching and learning and all the rest of it. And it just suited Nicholas's needs, and it gave him the steps he needed to really take on learning in full.
Oh, that is wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful. And, Oh, what other things? Tell us some more stories about other interests that developed as a result of your homeschooling of your child.
The mapping was the huge one. The interest in history was another one. Building. He started with Connects there. We would buy a packet of cereal, and in this cereal, they gave us free Connects packets. Now, do you know Connects building blocks at all?
No, I'm not, but there are other building blocks that are probably similar.
Yes,
but I'm not
Connects
familiar with those.
Connects is very special in that it's rods and they have connectors.
Uh-huh.
And so you can build, once you've got a few of them, you can build anything. And that was the start of Nicholas just zooming with, I need more connects.
Oh, my
goodness.
And
that's just amazing. Yeah, yeah. And the other thing, we bought a Nintendo there. We had a Nintendo in Australia. We bought this cheap one in England to fill their time, and they were quite new on the market then. And I remember Nathaniel, my eldest son, zooming through these programs, boom, 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 going through. And I remember watching Nicholas one day, and Nicholas didn't zoom through it. He sat there and blocked out every brick on the screen. And with that, he found things that the eldest didn't find.
Oh, my gosh.
I found this. Yes.
Oh,
yes,
my goodness.
It was just amazing to see the difference and see how methodical he was about it. And because he was methodical, he reached the end and he could give Nathaniel skills and keys that he needed to go on to various other levels.
Isn't that amazing? Oh,
yes.
That is just amazing. Mm-hmm. And he never, never would have had these wonderful experiences in the public school system. Ever.
Well, in any school system. No school system would cater for that, really. That was, Nicholas, as you say, is an incredibly different child. He's very special. And I needed that time at home to work with him. And I needed to do it one-on-one, me and him, and have no one else around because he is slower with his thinking with language. And he needed quiet. And if the younger brother was there, it was very hard to work with the two of them because Nicholas takes time to think with language. So when my mother-in-law was there, it was a huge help mm-hmm. with his learning so that we could work in a quiet environment.
Mm-hmm. And there are, that brings up another issue with any public school. I recall that when we moved from what was considered the city to the suburbs. Now, in the school that I was going to, you had to raise your hand. It was very quiet. You couldn't talk unless you raised your hand and was called upon. And then in the middle of the fifth grade, we transferred. We moved out to the suburbs. And the classroom was totally different. It was very noisy. There was a lot of... It was harder to think, and there's a lot of stimulation in classrooms now. You walk in, and there's these blasts of color and signs and noise and children getting up out of their desks and talking. And to me, I need quiet to think.
Yes, Nicholas needs quiet. Nicholas very much needs quiet. Even to hear the teacher's directions. You know, this became interesting, you know, that you have to get their attention. The teacher has to get the child's attention before they talk. Otherwise, they're coming into the sentence in the middle of it.
Right.
And the teacher might say, get out the, you know, your English book. And he might only hear book.
Right.
And what did she say? I don't know. So having the second and third grade teachers, the second and third grade teachers in Australia were utterly brilliant. And he still talks about Mrs. Raspaskowski, his third grade teacher. And he's been back to see her. He loved her so much.
Really?
Yes. She was brilliant. And she encouraged a love of learning as well and saw his strength. So yes, and he went back to see her just before he graduated.
Really? Was she happy to see him?
Oh, over the moon. Delighted, yes. Yeah. And she loved the chapter about her.
That is just terrific. And I think that many people go into teaching because they do love children and they do want to instill a love of learning in children. But I don't find that with some teachers they shouldn't be in that occupation. If you don't love children and if you don't love teaching children. And actually I think that providing information so that children can learn, I think there's a difference.
Yes. Yes.
That you don't actually teach children. You provide an environment where they can learn because that's when they remember and experience what they are doing, which is what you provided. You provided an environment and he learned from what you provided.
That's right. That's exactly right. We cannot teach children anything. We can only help them make all the connections they need to get the information they had. And I think that was originally Galileo.
Yes.
I think it's one of the quotes in my book too.
Yes.
Yeah. Fascinating, isn't it? How we've got to provide so much so that they can make the connections they need to make so that they can learn to read.
Right. And your use of poetry, poetry has a rhythm which would resonate with Nicholas, correct?
Yes, and it resonates with all of my students. Now, I don't know if you finished my book.
Tell us about we are going to a quick 3-minute break and then we'll talk about your other students.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, we are back. We are back and our guest is Lois Letchford, and her website is loisletchford.com, and she is the author of Reversed, a memoir, available anywhere that books are sold, and I think it's a must read for anyone that has anything to do with children. Anyway, you had, after your wonderful experience, setting up an environment where Nicholas could learn the way that he was able to process information and appreciate it and grow and accelerate and do all the wonderful things that he did and become immersed in so many various things that never would have happened in a classroom. But after that, you taught other students. So tell us about some of your experiences.
Well, after that, after I saw Nicholas be so successful. And I fell in love with teaching children like him. I went back and got my certification to become a reading teacher. And that became critical. And then we moved to Lubbock, Texas. And the first student I met was a 13-year-old, or I met a mother whose 13-year-old had spent 4 years in a phonics-only reading program, and he came out non-reading. And the school district, yes, he was the first one, and the school district employed me to teach him and then other students. And my next students were 15-year-olds, and they could not read the words, make a fist and do it. He read, one boy read make a first and knew that wasn't right, but didn't know what to do to get that, understand that sentence. And the second boy couldn't even read those words. And they left with me 3 years later, and one was reading on a fourth grade reading level and the other on a third grade reading level. And they're phenomenal, and I'm in touch with one of them still.
Marvelous. And these children, if you cannot read in America, you're very disadvantaged. You're going to end up, you could end up in prison.
Doing it anyway. Yes. And it's fascinating you say that, because one was an African American boy, the 15-year-old. And eventually we did a unit on volcanoes and volcanoes and earthquakes. And so this was 10 years ago when the tsunami in Indonesia happened. It was quite significant. And at the end of that segment, my 15-year-old said to me, I didn't know such a thing as volcanoes existed. And those words, they were his words.
Oh, my goodness.
They are... Yes, embedded in my mind, because it's what happens when you don't learn to read, you don't learn anything else either. And that's equally problematic.
Exactly. You have to read in order to learn anything about anything else, history or biography or you know, people's biographies, so you can look at what other people have done. Or geography, so you know what the world consists of, or like natural disasters, volcanoes.
Yes. Anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Reading is your vehicle to the rest of
the world.
Learning. The rest of learning.
Yeah. Mm. So that's what I remember about my 15-year-olds and my 13-year-old. You know, again, I taught him just the love of learning alongside reading. And one of the things that was most important for both these was to do readers' theatres plays so that you're reading something and having to practice it to put it on publicly. And you need all the props, you need the setting, you need to do all of these things. And that was exciting for everyone. And scary and nerve-wracking. But brilliant.
Yes, because you're putting more effort into other things that relate to the reading experience they've had.
Yes, and you're having to practice. You don't want to feel like an idiot.
But it feels like it's more playful. It feels like it's an extracurricular kind of a thing, a bonus.
Yes, for both groups, for all of my students. It's one of my ways of showing them what reading is all about. Because it's, you know, we think that reading is just about decoding, and these children can't do that. But the students I taught, now they, if you put them on an axis, an XY axis of age, chronological age on one axis, and reading age on another, mine are at the lowest point possible. They are reading on a first and second grade reading level. In fact, they were non-readers. So it becomes important to do the plays. What I was saying was their failure was that they hadn't even worked out that reading is a meaningful exercise.
Oh, my goodness. everybody. We are going to take a quick break. And we should take some phone calls from our listeners. We'll be right back. Back, and our guest is Lois Letchford. Her website is loisletchford.com. And in your teaching with your students, you felt that technology was also something that they should be familiar with and be able to use it. Now, if you can't read, then you really don't have a lot of use for a computer unless you just watch videos or something like that. But even then, you really do need to be familiar with it. And so tell us about some of the experiences you had with technology and how you used it.
At the time, my eldest son would have been, you know, same age as the students I was teaching, 15, 16, 17. Now, my son sitting in our house with a computer typing at 200 words a minute or something ridiculous, my students didn't even have an email address.
Wow.
And so you had this technological divide on top of a literacy divide. And so then I had to teach them how to use a computer, how to set up an email, send an email and receive it, all of those things, they all must be taught as well as learning to read. So that was the first thing I had to do with my students. Some students are not as bad as that, but when you grow up non-reading, and those boys both went to school every day for 10 years.
Oh.
Yes.
And
no,
they
were difficult. They came out, yeah, they were difficult to teach. There's no question about it. And I'm not blaming the schools and I'm not blaming the teachers because we don't give the teachers time or the tools to teach these who are so difficult, who don't get it the first or second time round. Mm-hmm. That's why the children fail.
And there's so much of that. Particularly in certain areas, it seems like, the teacher's union is more important than the students. It's really sad.
And well, I think it's the problem is bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
That Nicholas, you know, sits on the absolute extremes of our society. People don't have the time to deal with him. And the one person that did, the reading teacher, she didn't have the skills. And that comes down to a mindset. This child is not particularly smart and they have to do it this way. Mm. And it's changing and challenging that mindset more than anything else. And when I talk now to teachers,
right,
one of the first things I get them to do is, tell me about a child in your class or in your reading group who's really struggling. Tell me what you think about that child.
Mm.
And then at the end of the day, I want you, we'll come back and we'll look at now what can you do for this child? Because mindset, the way we think about the child and about ourselves is critical in how we approach the teaching of reading to them.
And children who have developed other skills are able to, they are empathic and they can read, they can feel how people think of them or what people think of them.
Yes. Yes, they do. They certainly do. And with my 15-year-olds and even the 13-year-olds, you've got failure upon failure upon failure. So when I come in, and I've spoken to both of these boys in the last year or two, they've both said, I didn't think that she would be able to help me. four, and one boy, my first student Christian, said, I don't know how big a task she thinks she can take on. I don't think I can do this. And so as a teacher, you really have to work with their attitude of, I can't do this. No one else has been able to do it. What are you going to do differently? How is she going to approach this differently to make an impact that is positive?
Right.
There's a lot in that, isn't there?
Yes. But it's really true.
Yes.
Oh, what a sad situation.
And you know, they all turned around, and it's fascinating to hear them talk about something, an event that happened, you know, 15 or so years ago. And they don't remember the particulars, but they say they remember the feeling in our classroom that with me, it was all okay. And there was a trust between us, and that they eventually went, she's going to help me. I can do this. And how that transformed their whole learning. Because my first student, Christian, he left high school with a degree, and then he went on to Texas Christian, and he got an honors degree in communication.
That's terrific. That is really terrific. And he, when he came into your classroom,
mm-hmm.
he knew
he was
that,
non-reading.
That, oh. And he would have.
And I know he was non-reading because I had him read a book that I use regularly with students, and he missed out the important pronoun of he in the sentence. And it totally changed the meaning of who did this on my head or something. And he missed out a word, and it totally lost the meaning of it. And he just plundered on because he hadn't worked out that reading was meaningful exercise. And when it doesn't make sense, you've got to do something about it. And he hadn't worked that out.
Right.
So, yeah.
And you said that, that it's like watching a child learn to walk.
Yes.
And
it's, you know, yes, it's so exciting when they finally get it.
Right.
Mm.
And what, now if he hadn't learned to read, what would have become of him?
Oh, I cannot. No, you cannot think. You cannot think. Because it's not only the learning to read, as you say, it's the emotional state.
Right.
You know, unlike the child you were talking about who was playing up in class.
Right.
What happens when you have failed for so long? And really, that's all you know then is failure.
Right.
How do you turn that around? I don't know, you know. So I... Believe me, every day I give thanks that my son learned to read at 7.
Right.
Because it gave him a chance of just enjoying school every day after that. To be successful and know I can do this.
The other thing too is, in the book you talk about, how can a non-reader even read signs on advertisements on the side of a bus,
or
really enjoy or understand their environment when they can't
read.
And they don't know what's going on. How do you relate to the world
if
you're a non-reader?
Yeah. I think it must be a very scary place.
Oh, indeed. Now he liked to listen to books.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Well, this is my extraordinary story, is that we moved from Brisbane, Australia to Lubbock, Texas, where my husband took a job, and Nicholas was 11. And because Lubbock, Texas, you know, is West Texas, it's flat, it's brown, it's boring, and people say there's not a hill or a tree to spoil the view, and you drive for miles on end, And the librarian said, here, listen to these books, listen to books on tape. And it transformed our driving and learning, and it transformed Nicholas's life again. Another transformation, because you're hearing the language of your peers at the same rate as the peers.
Yes.
So it's language, it's story structure, it's characters, it's everything that you need to have to succeed. And we listen to the same book two or three times at a time.
Mm-hmm. And if they have the book in their hand and are listening to it being read, that's a wonderful thing. Correct?
That was our, yes, that's right. The first experience was always just to listen
right.
and enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And the second experience was then to come back and follow. And that was a really tough exercise, because Nicholas's reading speed at the time was so slow. And the audiobooks compensated for the slow reading speed. And it really helped him catch up with the reading speed too. So it's quite amazing all the things that happened and have to happen to have children who are behind read on grade level.
Right. And sometimes the speed rate at which people read is very important, because many people read, when they're reading, they repeat each word in their head, which is not a great mm-hmm. thing to do, unless you're deliberately trying to do that. But if you read too slow, sometimes you don't get the concept that you're reading about. And so there are different techniques. I took a speed reading in college, mm-hmm. speed reading class. And we spent a lot of time on different techniques of reading. Instead of reading mm-hmm. One word at a time, you read a sentence at a time. And sometimes you get more from it. And also, if you don't repeat the word in your mind, you get more from it.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of things that I'm sure that you've delved into in your teaching that that probably affect the person's understanding of what they're reading. Correct?
Yes, I didn't do much of that. It was far more important to me and my students that they read and comprehended.
Right.
And then the level that you're talking about, then Nicholas took that on himself.
Ah.
No. Yes.
Isn't
because
that
Nicholas
amazing?
Now reads. Yes. Yes. He reads everything. He reads fellow colleagues, PhD thesis. You know, he's reading academic papers across a wide range of fields, and he can do it all.
Aren't you proud of him?
Oh, I'm proud of his wife too, because she's patient with him. And, she, you know, it's coming back to me through her, the discrepancy. She says at times, oh, Lois, he couldn't do it. And I was just shocked that this boy with a PhD couldn't do
really?
These simple things. Yes. Yes. Well, she's a lawyer and she's a brilliant reader. And, you know, a mm-hmm. fast reader and all the rest of it. So it's quite a contrast. And I think it's only as she lives with him on a day-to-day basis that she sees the big differences, and she sees the amount of effort and work that he puts in to get to where he is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes. But he reads everything. So, but my goal is to have children read for comprehension and to enjoy the reading experience, because when you enjoy it, you will do more of it.
Oh, absolutely.
If it's painful, you say, oh, I can't do that.
Of course.
Like
nobody
reading.
Wants. Nobody
like
wants
reading
to
Tolkien for me.
Like reading who?
Tolkien or Tolstoy for me.
Oh, yes.
Painful.
They're not too bad.
Well, we listened to Tolkien once. We did a trip, and we had Tolkien on the whole way, The Lord of the Rings.
Uh-huh.
And I remember just zoning out and not having a clue what was going on. And the boys are hanging on every word.
Well, because that's more fantasy and that kind of thing. But yeah. Wouldn't you say that they would enjoy adventure?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes, yes. And it's a, you know, it's a classic, isn't it now? And they did, they loved it, but it lost me, it just lost me.
Yes.
So I want reading to be an enjoyable, a positive experience. That's the most important thing for me. The starting point anyway.
Yes. And you've presented all over your theories and your methods of teaching reading. You've been able to present your ideas to other teachers and have been instrumental in them, in those teachers developing programs that would help their students, correct?
Yes, yes.
Now I know you don't like to pat yourself on the back.
Well, you know, to me there's so much that goes on in reading that we don't see. We just make assumptions. And when you teach these children who are sitting down the bottom, you've got to get everything right. You can't make any assumptions about anything. And that's what I tell my teachers. And I give examples of how this works. And then they go back and go, ah, I can do this, this, and this. So yes, and I'm actually going on a tour of Queensland. This is my last weekend in the States for a month.
Wow.
I'm going back to my home for my mum and dad's 70th wedding anniversary next Saturday.
How wonderful.
Yes. And then after that, I am talking at some libraries, but I'm also talking with a group called Spelled, which is learning difficulties. And I'm talking in 4 regional centers of the state about teaching. So that'll be great fun. I'm really looking forward to all of this next month. And then I'm talking at the Ireland International Conference on Education in April. And where else am I going? I'm going to Kansas. I'm going to talk in Kansas to the school to the reading teachers in the school district in Kansas.
Derby, wonderful.
When you
go back to Australia, I wonder if any of the teachers that Nicholas had would be attending your presentation. Wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't it be interesting if Susan was there? Okay, we will be right back in just 3 minutes. Be right back. Deanna, and we will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443. What is your feeling about, you've referenced it just briefly, about the number of days that children attend school during the year? Now, it used to be that people in an agrarian society where there was farm work to be done, that children had 3 months off of school, which seems now would interrupt the educational process, and they would have to really work harder come September whenever they go back to school or when. What is your feeling on that?
Our society has changed and schooling has changed. But see, I grew up in Australia where we only have a maximum of 6 weeks off. And more breaks throughout the year. So teaching is a job that is done 12 months of the year, basically. But you're right. I think 3 months off is too long, particularly when children are then not exposed to any literature during that time.
Right.
And here's, you know, a possibility of wealth distribution. The rich will have their children in every summer program and exposed to everything, which is fantastic for them. And those that can't afford it, what happens? You know, it's a very interesting problem that has to be addressed, I think.
That is a consideration to factor in. You in your teaching with Nicholas, you said that you used short, simple poems, and you also used these with Pedro and Twain. Let me just share one. Or would you like to share it? A tip, top, tap.
Yes, you do it. You've got it open.
A tip, grandma, tap. Tip, top, tap. Grandma bought a cat. Did she buy an old cat? Did she buy a wise cat? No, she bought a big, fat, black cat. And Twain smiled. One of your students smiled and said, I can write a poem like that. And he does.
Yes.
What a great way of appealing to a child. What a great example. And it's simple enough that
yes, I've used this poem with a number of children. And you think, oh, you know, there's nothing profound in that. And the children love it. And they come back, and even changing one word changes the author. Now, and with my other students, it'll be by Miss Lois Ann. And so it's fascinating that the children love that one. And then once they have written it, they come back to it and reread it again and again and again, which is what you want for poetry and for reading.
And because they have pride in what they've accomplished, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Fabulous, fabulous.
Yeah.
Okay, we're at the top of the hour, and we do invite your phone calls when we get back. Be right back.
Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth. Truth.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Lois Letchford, and her website is loisletchford.com. She is the author of Reversed, a memoir. It is available wherever books are sold. And it is about her son, Nicholas, a wonderful individual that has excelled because of the, well, because he was open and Lois was willing and able and loving enough to teach him in the way that he could learn, and it worked, and he didn't get lost in the, wherever children get lost at if they're unable to read, which is a terrible thing to think about. Okay, we will take your calls at 800-313-9443. Now, getting back to one of your students, Christian, you suggested that perhaps they should go to the library. I think library visits are so wonderful. Gosh, a lot of children on vacation or in their free time are maybe watching TV, correct?
Yes.
And you don't learn how to read when you're watching TV.
You know, it's even more than that. Stephen King said, reading is brain food. Reading is thinking. And the TV stops you thinking.
Because you're not interacting with it. When you're reading, you are participating. And that is all the difference. You're just simply being entertained or programmed via TV.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. You might eventually think about something, but yes, you're right. It's an entertainment.
Right. We had a TV when my children were young. We decided we would get rid of it. And I had not realized how much I had depended on the TV to tend to the children while I was fixing dinner or doing laundry or something. And it was quite a revelation to me when we got rid of the TV and what a difference it made. But anyway, tell us a little bit about Christian and the library visits and how it helped him.
Christian would have been 13 years old at that stage, and it would have been our first summer together. So we're working together and we're reading these stories, and we went and started to explore Mount Everest. And so with Mount Everest, you're looking at all sorts of picture books. And we were collecting books and taking them and drooling over these pictures and thinking about what it's like to walk at ridiculous height where there's lack of oxygen. And one of my books said that, you know, walking in Everest is like breathing through a straw.
Mm.
And he was just enamored with it. And it was an experience he had never had until he could learn to read and understand all about it. And he went back to his mother and was talking like he'd been to a whole new world. And she was amazed and surprised about the whole experience.
That's
what I remember. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Sorry.
Wonderful.
Mm.
Absolutely wonderful. Let's take a phone call. Let's take Sherry in Kansas. Sherry, welcome.
Hi, Deanna.
Hi, how are you?
Hey. You know, y'all were talking about how they can't interact so much when they don't know how to read and how they can't decode things. Deanna, remember when you had James LaFond on?
Yes,
about the history of American slavery, and he said reading was the key to a lot of those people to be able to fill out and get out of slavery, especially if they were kidnapped and stuff.
Right.
Pressed into service. Remember that?
Yes. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, that was – anyway, that's all I had, but this is a very interesting show.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. That is true, that people are not able to go beyond their so-called, quote-unquote, station in life unless they know how to read. And that's why they
didn't
really
want to... At that time, reading was the slaves were not allowed to read because
right.
It was recognized if they read, they would have the power. And
right.
That's why they stopped them from reading. And now I bring this into my reading education. When I am teaching students of various races, I attempt to get books where they are in the pictures and the story is about them. And that becomes a critical component of reading, that they are seeing themselves in the text.
Great. Wonderful idea.
Yeah.
They can certainly relate much better if they have some relevancy to the imagery in a book.
Yes. And the stories, and they're able to make connections that aren't always available when you're using just a standardized text. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Is that how you say her name? Path of Yellow Sun with her books and a recent one on feminism. She has a podcast on the power of the single story, and it really brought it home to me about the importance of culturally teaching, or teaching appropriately and teaching culturally to our students.
Right.
And in fact,
go ahead.
I grew up with the Dick and Jane books, because I'm old now. And I remember wondering who or what these things were on the page, because I had no understanding for these people who were immaculately dressed in coats and shoes and socks and cats that are running and dogs that are running. Because we grew up on a farm, and my parents were dairy farmers morning and night, and our animals were working animals. So for me, it was a, what's happening here? I mean, where does this happen? So it's very interesting that that was my personal experience of learning as well. It was an alienating experience. It wasn't a positive experience.
Hmm. Yes, you do talk about your family, and when you almost drowned in the, when you decided to jump into the water and went under.
That was scary. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
That was scary.
I can understand your point there. And if you don't, if you can't relate to what you're reading, it's certainly not going to be an impact on your life.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. As Christian overcame his struggles, and he went to a Bible class. Tell us a little bit about that.
He went to his church, and it would have been at the end of the summer. And he had a new teacher who didn't know him from anyone and asked him to read a passage from the Bible.
Oops.
And he had the confidence to stand up and to do it. And he came back with such a smile on his face. Mum, I did it. I was able to do it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, yes. It was a big deal, and, you know, that he had the confidence to say, I can, and I did, and she didn't know I had a problem with reading, and once that would have just destroyed me, but I read it slowly, but I read it. And doing those sort of things publicly is a huge deal for children.
It's a huge deal even for good readers to stand up and read anything.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
I've got my pussycat sitting beside me and he's attacking me.
Ah, I have a cat-free office and I close the door. Otherwise, they would be, I have two male cats. One of them is a narcissistic cat. He thinks that the world revolves around him. Yes. And, he would be on the desk, sitting on the keyboard. He would be stealing things off the desk, meowing loudly. It would not be a good experience. But he would enjoy it.
It's wonderful to have them.
It is. It is. Cats are wonderful little companions.
Yes.
All righty. Now, what are some of the other things that you have employed in your teaching methods that have been very effective and have really helped? We've talked about the poetry. What are the cultural differences, which I think is incredibly important, not just the cultural difference, not just national differences, or differences in ethnicity. That's important.
It is important. You know, it is making it, I think it goes back to all the time making the connections with the students and letting them see that you are taking them from where they are and not from where you want them to be. So when they can't do something, you you don't have an explosion. It's, they can't do this. How am I going to teach it in a way that will engage them? And that's different than standardized reading programs where you just hand it out and the child is going to do this. So that is key, that I'm always looking at the two steps. What do I have to do and how am I going to do it? And then they've got the third and more, almost the most critical part, is what material am I going to use? If I've done a lesson or an activity, what material will I engage them in? Mm-hmm. And that is the most challenging part, is finding books at their level, at their interest, with the right number of words on the page so it's not overwhelming, and the right number of characters. All of that is the most difficult part of the job. So I have to read and read and read and read to make sure I've got things that I think they will enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Agree. The other thing too, before TV became a really big thing where parents used it for babysitting purposes and whatnot, children read more, and children read comic books. At least I did. I had so many comic books, and I read all the time, just all the time. I always had a comic book in my hand, and that made it easier to graduate to other books that were more involved. And of course, you have the illustration in the comic books. And so when you grow up in a family of readers, and my mother says, oh, your dad always has his face in a book. And that was true.
Yeah.
He read all the time, when he probably shouldn't have been reading, paying more attention, according to my mother, to the family, he was reading. And so I grew up with a family that really appreciated reading. And I've just always been a reader. In fact, that is my favorite way of learning. I think that people can learn to do absolutely anything from a book, including cake decorating, even things that, talents like that, where they can read the directions and, apply those directions and create something, whether you're talking about quilting or cake decorating or something like that. I think that you can, cookbooks. You can learn to be a great cook using a cookbook. And it just galls me when I see these TV ads that talk about that they're going to send you this box of food. And what is that all about? People can't
read a cookbook.
Go ahead.
I can say to you that I am jealous of you. And I am jealous of people like my husband, because you both grew up in a household with books and you could read with ease and you knew how to access them. I grew up reading words, and because I could read words and I couldn't comprehend, well, the teacher said, well, she's not very smart. And every time I picked up a book, it was a huge physical effort for me to read. And that's what I remember of reading as a child. And I hated comic books. I still don't
really?
Like them.
Oh, they were just the best. I graduated from comic books to other things, but that was...
They're huge.
Or what about nursery rhymes? I always read to my children. I read to my children when they were 3 months old. I would read to them.
Yes.
Because I felt that the soothing voice and they developed a love of reading from the crib up.
Yes.
They just, we went to the library every other day.
Yes. I didn't have that experience. My personal experience was not like that at all, because my parents were busy putting food on the table.
Right,
and we had no money.
Cows and all that other stuff.
Yes. Morning and night. and we had no money for books, and my mother was not a reader. My father was the reader, but not my mother. My mother's strength was in sewing and the ability to imagine a dress in her mind, draw the pattern, draw the picture of what she wants, draw the pattern, cut it out and make it. And that was her strength, her visual strength.
Wow.
But she's,
That's good.
She only became a reader later on in life too. Mainly due to, books on CD again when she was with us. So yes, so it was quite a switch for me. And I think when I come to teaching reading, my own background plays a role because I did grow up with just reading words. And so when I read the research about what else goes wrong in the reading process, I'm going back to my background and thinking, well, what did go wrong? What did happen? And it's interesting you say about recipes. I remember I would have been about 10 or 11 years old, and my mother said, yes, we're going to bake a cake. And the recipe said, cream the butter and the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my mother, Mum, I need some cream.
Oh.
Now I can tell you why that was a problem.
Well, it sounds logical if you're not used to reading a cookbook.
Well, it's also the language component that
words
have multiple meaning. And you go with...
You grew up on a dairy farm. What else are you going to think of it other than it's cream, right?
That's right. Unless someone says to you, putting butter and sugar together becomes cream, and we call it creaming butter and sugar, and this word has multiple meanings,
right.
I did think, yes, and that's how I remember learning to read with recipes. Cream the butter and sugar.
Right.
Cream. Mum, I need cream.
Now, there was a program teaching your baby how to read, and my husband and I had adopted a child. There were 11 years difference between our last child, our daughter, and this adopted child. Okay, we'll be right back.
Okay.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, we are back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Lois Letchford, and her website is loisletchford.com. She is the author of Reversed, a memoir, and it is a must-read book if you have anything to do with children, which we all do, in some one way or another. But anyway, we adopted this child. She was an out-of-culture adoption. She was born with fetal alcohol syndrome, and she came to us at the age of 5 months. And I wanted to give her every advantage that I possibly could so that she could overcome the situation into which she was born. And so I purchased this book. It was called How to Teach Your Baby How to Read. And that book is actually still available. And what I did was I labeled everything in the house.
Everything. Yes.
Refrigerator, everything that I could. I put a great big label on everything. And we played school every day. Every day we played school.
Yeah.
And I think that it helped her. And in the long run, I hope that it helped her. And later on, she was able to develop great piano skills. Because I think that when you learn to read, that it affects your other skills, physical skills. So I think that we should do what we can with our children, as you have done, to give them the appropriate, lessons, the appropriate information. And, whether you're reading to your child when they're in the crib, 3 months or designing flashcards, which came with, I believe I also bought a kit that went with the book, and it was fun, and it brought us closer together as a mother and child.
I did the same thing with Nicholas, named everything in the house, so it's
wonderful.
A name for it. Yes, I think now I would do it in a sentence, not just a name.
Ah.
So that you're doing, this is a refrigerator.
Better
this
idea.
Is a chair. Yes, because we don't read isolated words. We read everything in a sentence.
How true. That is so true. Yes, that is a much better.
And then you, yeah. And then you're dealing with the problems with children who struggle are these tense things too. The is, are, was, were. And mm-hmm. So you're also dealing with that. So if you've got a sentence there, this is the refrigerator, they get to know that is means now. Because you don't say this was a refrigerator.
Right.
So it's very important that you do those things. And a lot of my work actually comes from speech therapy. There's an overlap between speech therapy and what I do. And when Nicholas was in speech, we did a lot of work with the tense. Just oral language. We are walking down the street. Mm-hmm. We, and then we would stop. Or, and then you start with, we were walking. And they need to hear that oral language so much more to help them with their learning. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of my students, even now, older students, I ask them to give me a sentence with the word were, we were, W-E-R-E, and mm-hmm. W-H-E-R-E, and they struggle with it. Even though they're two entirely different words. The were is a tough one.
Right.
Unless they're really good with language. Skilled children who have no problems with learning and learning to read, know these things. The children who are sitting on the borders of language difficulties, whether they've got a label or not, whether they're dyslexic or learning disabled, they struggle with some of these language tasks that you would expect them to be fairly easy.
Mm-hmm. Even singular and plural.
Yes. Yes.
Okay,
even singular and plural. And it changes too, doesn't it? It's not consistent. I was, we were.
Right.
And then with the younger students, they start, we was. Oh no, that's not right. And you see their brain really clicking over and thinking, oh, what is it? I was on the separate slide. We were. And it takes a lot of practice and takes a lot of hearing to get that language right.
The other thing that has become a problem, I believe, is the disintegration of the language through texting and social media, where LOL, lots of laughs, it's disintegrating the language, where people, particularly younger people, are losing their ability to communicate because they're not doing it properly. What I would consider properly, they are, okay, we will be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good.
All right, we are back. Our guest today is Lois Letchford. Her website is loisletchford.com. She is the author of Reversed, a memoir. And we're talking about the disintegration of the
language. And I'm chuckling. I am laughing.
Why is that?
Well, we think that language is static. And we think it's always been the same.
Oh.
But I've come to believe that language
We, the people, are the drivers of the language. And language evolves. The language that we had 150 and 200 and 300 years ago would have been saying exactly the same as what you're saying. This language is deteriorating. People can't spell correctly and. But we, the people, drive the language. And as technology comes in and all sorts of things, language changes and evolves. It's not static. So it's just another evolution of language. That's my take on it.
Oh, and you're right. But I do hate to see the technology disadvantage young people to the point that they can't even write a paragraph or they can't get through a paragraph without saying or speaking a paragraph without saying like. Have you ever heard someone say like?
Yes, I've heard this change. Yes, that it's, you know, coming then from language into the written language and the oral language, and they can't even speak in the end. Yes, I've heard that.
Right.
But you know, I think we are continually. There will always be the academic language, but it's the language of the people will change. Sorry, I missed that.
That is so unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's the way it goes, isn't it? You know, you look at the way English has grown up and American English has grown up and they spell things just a little bit differently and why that's happened. And, you know, and 200 years ago when I was dealing with Nicholas and Captain Cook, and you can see all these things online now, how he was spelling and how there was no ED at the time on anything. So there's, you know, and it's hard to read things that are older because of the language and the way it was written at those times.
Right.
And even now, books are written in a different style than they were 20 or 30 years ago. And, you know, some of them are even harder to read because that style of language has moved on. And you have to think more about what they're writing about.
Right. They also, they do not teach cursive in school anymore, which is very disturbing to me. Or if they're teaching it, they're not teaching it the way that I learned it. And I think that's really sad. I think it's a great disadvantage. And the other thing that really irritates me to no end, when a presenter or somebody is talking to a mixed group of people, females and males, to say something like "you guys," or when I'm in a restaurant, the waiter comes up and there's two ladies sitting there, and he says, "What would you guys like to have?" And I have actually said, "I do not see any men here. We are ladies." anyway, that's just...
They're colloquialisms, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yeah. So tell me how you came about writing the book. It was a challenge for you, correct?
Oh, enormous challenge. Enormous challenge. Yes.
Well, tell us
about... my husband moved. My husband moved and we were, you know, we've been across this Pacific Ocean too many times and we moved to upstate New York. And I cannot teach in upstate New York. So I finished my degree, my master's degree in literacy, which I thoroughly enjoyed doing, but I didn't want to do any more study because it was just too stressful. Someone said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, I'd really like to write up Nicholas's story. Because at that time, Nicholas had just completed an honors degree in mathematics and engineering. He hadn't started a PhD program yet. So coming to that and getting honors degrees was a huge step. And I just thought, I want to write my story up. And so what I did was for the next 6 months, I just sat down and wrote the story out. And what I wrote initially was what the book ended up being because it follows a pattern. It follows the story of over the years and what countries we were in. But I knew it wasn't good enough. And so I started to go to writing class. And the first class I went to, I shared one of my stories and someone said, well, you've got the tense wrong. And, you know, I still remember it, don't I? You got the tense wrong.
Yes. See how that works? Yes.
Yeah. And, anyway, I stuck at it. But then I went to another writing class and there was a young girl there and we were asked to edit people's works. And she edited, I think she edited everyone's the same. Her edits were incredible. And she said to me, if you ever want to do any work, let me know. Because she trained as an editor and she was just doing odd jobs at the time. And I got in touch with her and she helped me enormously. She actually helped me, taught me to write. She edited my work. We worked on that first chapter, which started as about 5 pages, and then it ended up being 20 pages, and we knew we had to do something about it. And she was phenomenal. And she was the one who said, every person in your book has to be a character. They've got to have characteristics, and this is the way you've got to write it. And that's how the book came about. And it really came about because of her support. I could not have written that book independently. And it comes from two reasons. Because I do have a learning disability, I live with it. And then on top of that, you haven't had the practice you need to become a successful writer. So, in the last 3 years, I've been writing and writing and writing.
Wonderful. Yes. Your book is wonderful. And the development of the people that you talk about, you feel like you know them, as a complete person because you filled out their characteristics and their problems and the solutions to those problems and how they worked it out, how they felt. You've included what they did, how they felt about what they did, their success. I would say that's really remarkable.
And the other component of my book is the structure. You know, you start off, it's really sad at the beginning. And that whole first year is sad. And then you meet Rob Cusack, so everyone gets a lift. Then there's a positive in grade two. And then we go to England, and my luggage falls apart. So there's humour.
Yes.
And then we...
That's not too funny when it happens.
My poor mother, I should have put a bit more about her. Mortified. And then, you know, then there's the failure, my failure with Nicholas again. So the emotion is you're going down. And then there's the success. You know, and then you follow it with, he's the worst child I've seen in 20 years of teaching, which comes right in the middle of the book, which you don't expect. So that makes it, you know, everyone's with you then. And from there on, it's an uphill ride. You know, you're getting better and better and better, and the book's going along nicely and smoothly until Nicholas then goes to junior high. And then you've got that teacher being mean and nasty, and you're slapped down again. So, and then you have to, the book picks up again, and everyone feels the strength and the work that he did to achieve. But so his life was like that, and so the book was able to follow the ups and downs. And so I really am pleased that the book has come out as well as it has with all of those emotions that people connect with.
Right. And people do, well, at least I did, really connect to what you're feeling and your sadness, but also your triumphs. And poor Nicholas, his character is so well developed and so I did shed tears over his first grade experience.
Yes.
I could not help it because it was just so well written. And
thank you.
It was. I just It broke my heart to read about his experience. And what does he think about the book?
There's a video clip of him talking about the book and me, and he says, my mum is inspirational. He will not read the book. We've read parts to him, and his wife has read it all, but he won't read the book because of just what you said, too emotional, and it's too hard for him to go back and read it.
I understand. He he lived it. He doesn't have to read the book.
He lived it. That's exactly what he says. I lived it. And, you know, when I was talking to him about various things, I remember he was talking to him. He's in a PhD program, and I'm talking to him about the experience in the junior high when the teacher was nasty to him.
Mm-hmm.
Day one, period one, of a new school. And Nicholas burst into tears. And he's trying to cover his tears with laughter and thinking about all the teachers who were wonderful to him and all the wonderful experience. And then he would sob again, thinking about that day. These days impact our children forever. We can't take them away. We can't lessen them. I think they lessen over time and you don't think about them. But when he does think about it, it's soul destroying.
Exactly.
The other person I talked to him about recently was, you know, who do you remember from your elementary school, from the early years? And he said, I don't remember my first grade teacher or my second grade teacher. Don't remember. I remember Mrs. Raspaskowski, and I remember Mrs. Hinksman, and he called them by name, and such positive experiences with them. I don't remember that other person. Nicholas, I said, what about your reading teacher? And he sat there and he said, my reading teacher? Did I have a reading teacher? I said, Nicholas, you were with this reading teacher 4 days a week, half an hour a day, one-on-one for about 4 years. And he goes, my reading teacher? Ah, my reading teacher. He says, she was a witch. Have I lost you?
I'm sorry, you cut out. Yes, you cut out. What was she? He said
she was a witch.
Oh,
she
yes.
She was a witch.
Yes.
And that's his memory. And so when teachers are working with students, it's really good to think, what will this kid think of me in 20 years' time? I think it's a sobering reflection. What will they remember?
Well, he was certainly accurate when he did remember. And no wonder he didn't recall immediately. It was such a bad...
Yes, that's right.
A bad experience. Oh.
Yeah, it was.
Gosh.
And I didn't know that. I didn't know that. That's what I would say. I didn't know.
Right.
So, and you only learn these things as children get older, and you do reflect, and because his experience has been such a, you know, dramatic change. And I think we underestimate children that are struggling, their depth and their emotion and what they are learning.
Right. But children remember. And he does have a phenomenal memory. So he probably remembers every terrible thing that any teacher ever said to him.
Yes. Or, you know, he's tried to hide it and it's buried somewhere in his memory, but he really doesn't want to open that cabinet.
Of course
not.
Because
I think exactly what you said. Yes. Yeah. So it's certainly been a learning experience. Even looking at it from this end for me, I have been surprised at how much or how little he said. And then when you do talk about it,
you know, he just dissolves into tears. Or then the story, you know, with the poetry with me, you've got the other child, the one that was happy and excited about learning. So we've got a big job to do as teachers. It's more than just teaching children to read.
That is
so true. We can't measure that.
No. Now, when he went away to school, and in your prologue, you write about this. And I can tell just the way that you phrased it, that you're still concerned, overly concerned. And you say, pacing the carpeted floor of my home in upstate New York, I await an email, a message, or a Skype call. Anything.
Anything.
I think Nicholas should have contacted me by now. I know my son had walked into his oral examination, known as a Viva, at the same time I woke up. It was noon at his university in Oxford, 7 a.m. in the States. And you just waited and waited. And then he did contact you. Yeah. But you say the clock ticks away painfully slow. Isn't that beautiful writing? A text message comes through from Nicholas's girlfriend. Okay, we'll pick this up on the other side. We'll be right back. We are back with our guest, Lois Letchford, and her website is loisletchford.com. And you're waiting to hear from Nicholas, and you're waiting to hear from Nicholas, and you're waiting and waiting, and you're getting worried. So tell us, pick up the story from then, from there.
Well, there's nothing you can do but wait, is there?
Yes.
And what had actually happened was that he had done 5 hours of questioning. Now, when you do a PhD exam in Oxford, the student, the PhD candidate, sits in a room with 2 or 3 other experts, and they go through each page of your thesis, the 200 pages or whatever it is, and they pull it to pieces and do whatever. So he did 5 hours of questioning. He said, I explained to them at the beginning, or he had paperwork to say he has dyslexia, he has a learning difficulty, and he would have a break every hour.
Oh,
so that
okay.
helped him. But, and then they do that. They did their 5 hours, and then he goes out of the room, and the examiners discuss the thesis. Is it good enough? Is it not good enough? And when he... That 20 minutes feels like forever. And they came back and said, yes, it's okay, but he had some changes to do. But then after that, he called his girlfriend and talked to her for a while, and there were other things. So I was the last on the list.
eventually
call me and say yes. And he was exhausted.
Team
I know
Network.
It. Incredibly.
Because you can handle the truth.
It's an incredibly long day, and it's a very stressful day. But anyway, he got through it, he made the changes, and he did get a PhD.
Wonderful.
He graduated last May in 2018, and the night before he graduated, my mother-in-law, his grandmother, died, and that was really
oh,
sad
dear.
That she, yes, because she was a huge
yes.
influence in his life, in our lives. And that she would have known that she had just, you know, she couldn't do any more. So, it was a big deal.
Yes, she transitioned and she's just, she knew, she just transitioned.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So we will always remember her death.
Yes. Yes. Well, what a fabulous, fabulous story. And What he said was, he said, I want to jump through the computer and give you an enormous hug. I cry in shame, knowing the incredible fight we faced to reach this moment. Nicholas follows, that is what you said. Nicholas follows with a simple thanks, Mom. Then softly and matter-of-factly, my thesis is completed. You can publish your book now.
Thank you for reading my book and feeling the emotion with it, because you're crying and I'm crying.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you for being on the program. And my love and hugs to you for being who you are. And my love to Nicholas. Tell him I said hello.
I will do.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. We'll chat next week. Have a great week. Bye-bye.